Hi, I'm Neil Denny, and you're about to listen to the next Little Atoms Road Trip podcast. I'm in New York City. I'm here to attend a few events at the World Science Festival. This afternoon, I attended a really great event called Refining Cosmology at NYU, and one of the speakers at the event was today's podcast guest, Britt Reichborn-Schenerud. Earlier in the day, I spent some time with Britt in her office at Columbia University here in New York, and we recorded the upcoming interview. Britt Reichborn-Schenerud received her PhD from Columbia University in 2010. During her graduate career, she held a NASA fellowship, and she's currently an NSF Astronomy and Astrophysics postdoctoral fellow in Amber Miller's lab at Columbia University. An experimental astrophysicist, Britt uses measurements of the cosmic microwave background, or the CMB, the afterglow of the Big Bang, to understand the origin, composition, and evolution of the universe. She has been a member of the EBEX experimental team at the Miller Lab since 2005 and is currently overseeing the work of the Columbia team as they prepare to deploy the EBEX instrument to Antarctica later this year. This experiment will map a patch of the microwave sky from the top of the stratosphere while hanging from a NASA helium balloon. The resulting dataset holds the promise of detecting a signal that originated when the universe was just a tiny fraction of a second old. Okay, so I'm sat in Columbia University Physics Department with Britt Reichborn-Schenerud. Britt, welcome to Little Atoms. Thanks for talking to me today.
Thanks for coming.
This is Amber Miller's lab that we're in. Tell us about what actually happens here.
We build microwave telescopes here to study the cosmic microwave background. And we're experimental cosmologists, which means we want to understand how did the universe begin, how did it evolve over time, what is it made of, what is the geometry of space, and sort of big, large-scale questions like this.
Before we look at that in a little bit more detail, perhaps tell me a little bit about your background, how you came to be here in this lab.
I majored in astronomy as an undergraduate, and actually, you know, if you asked me when I was 5 years old what I wanted to do, I would have told you I wanted to be an astronaut, so I've always loved astronomy. Always been interested in science, and during college I did some research and then took a break and went traveling to Australia, taught high school, and then came back to New York and taught high school for another 5 years, then eventually found my way back in academia, and I did my PhD in physics here at Columbia. And when I started, I looked at the various options, and cosmology sounded like the most exciting thing. I actually had done absolutely no building of anything whatsoever, so I was completely green and completely new, and just liked it straight away.
Let's talk a little bit about cosmic background radiation then. What is it?
Well, our universe is now about 14 billion years old, and when the universe was very, very young, so after the Big Bang, only about 380,000 years afterwards, so that sounds old, but compared to 14 billion years, mm-hmm. It's a very early universe. The universe was extremely hot, and you know, it was filled with different particles, like atoms like you and I know about, protons, electrons, neutrons, light, neutrinos, and so on, more exotic particles. And it was so hot that the electrons and protons actually weren't bound together in atoms. They were all sort of free and bouncing around and scattering off each other. They were all tightly coupled, we say. And for this reason, the light particles, or light waves, the photons, couldn't travel anywhere across the universe. Everything was sort of bouncing around in a relatively small area. As the universe expanded, you know, it started in the Big Bang and it was continually expanding, and it still expands today. As it expanded, the universe cooled. And once it cooled enough that the electrons could become bound to the protons into atoms, the light particles were no longer bouncing off the electrons and were able to free stream out. Mm-hmm. So everywhere in the universe, here where we're sitting now and all the way across the universe, these light particles were leaving their current position and streaming in every direction. And so this is what we call the cosmic microwave background. Mm-hmm. It was actually ultraviolet light at that time. It was higher energy light, but as the universe has been expanding, those particular wavelengths of light have been stretching with the expansion, and they've stretched from ultraviolet to microwave.
So how did we, tell us about the story about how we come to discover the cosmic background radiation, because it's quite a fun story.
Yeah, so cosmic background radiation was predicted by a number of people, Gamow and Hermann mm-hmm. and Alpher and so on, and the temperature that it should appear at was predicted as well, not exactly accurately. And there were some people at Princeton, including Dickey and so on, were in the process of building experiments to study the background radiation. Mm-hmm. But before they completed their experiments at Bell Labs, a radio telescope was receiving a signal that wasn't understood. And they ended up calling Princeton, you know, do you have any idea what's going on? Mm-hmm. And they realized that they'd been scooped. The cosmic background radiation had already been discovered. And, you know, of course, that was really just the first step. I mean, it was very exciting to discover it, but that was just that first discovery. So it hadn't yet been characterized at all.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and that was by Penzias and Wilson, who eventually won the Nobel Prize because they, in fact, did discover it.
What does it tell us then? What does that discovery actually mean?
Yeah, it tells us that particular discovery, you know, tells us about the Big Bang, that it happened, that our sort of understanding of the expanding universe, you know, it's very consistent with mm-hmm. what we had understood from looking at, you know, light of receding galaxies and so on. But subsequent measurements, you know, there's a bunch of ground-based measurements, but also the COBE satellite and the WMAP satellite are huge milestones. They tell us a lot about the universe. And, of course, the reason is because this is a baby picture of the universe, right? Mm-hmm. You know, the universe was just 380,000 years old. There weren't even atoms really formed. They were just coming together mm-hmm. when this light was released. So there were yet no stars, galaxies, and so on. It was very amorphous and no sort of astronomical structures like we see today. So that little baby picture of the universe, plus what we understand about physics and what we can observe today, that allows us to understand, you know, what is the universe made of? There's ordinary matter like you and I are made of that mm-hmm. consists of protons and electrons and so on. There's light, radiation. This is all no news to us. But there's also dark matter, which we actually didn't discover through the CMB.
Mm-hmm.
We understood it through light curves of galaxies, the way galaxies rotate. But this is sort of an orthogonal confirmation of the existence of dark matter and really how much of the energy density in our universe now and over time has there been in dark matter. And then also dark energy, which is really a major mystery. Mm-hmm. It's a really bizarre thing because it's causing the acceleration of the expansion of the universe. So when you think about something expanding, like you think about throwing up a ball, you don't think about it speeding up as mm-hmm. it goes up. And that's essentially what's happening, is the universe is currently expanding at an accelerated rate. And this is really exciting because you can also probe, for example, dark energy using measurements of supernovae. So this is a completely orthogonal measurement mm-hmm. and provides really strong confirmation that, in fact, dark energy exists. And also, again, how much is there now? How much was there in the past? You know, what is the consequence of it?
Let's talk a little bit about what's going on in this lab then at the moment. There are numerous experiments going on, and we'll talk about the one that you're involved in more detail. But let's talk about what else there is, first of all.
Yeah, so there's one experiment called the Quiet Experiment, and that experiment has completed observations, I think about 1.5 or somewhere in the last couple of years,
mm-hmm.
and they're currently analyzing their data. So they've already released some papers, but they're continuing to analyze the data, so that's ongoing. And then there's a new effort to work on detector characterization development. So, you know, we're looking at signals that are very, very faint.
Mm-hmm.
So we're looking for changes of 1 in a million, essentially. And so we need very good detectors that aren't noisy and are very well understood and behave very well. And so there's an effort to do detector characterization development.
Mm-hmm.
And finally, the full experiment that's being integrated at this time is called EBEX. And that's the one that I've been working on since 2005. And EBEX is a balloon-borne experiment. So it's a microwave telescope attached to a big frame called a gondola. And it's about 6,000 pounds, a couple stories high, and it gets launched on a big helium balloon up to about 110,000 feet, eventually over Antarctica at the end of this year.
So before we talk about EBEX then, tell me a little bit more about Quiet. What's that experiment actually doing?
Quiet is doing, or was doing, the same thing that a lot of the experiments are doing now. So a lot of the first measurements of the CMB were focused on looking at the temperature, the absolute temperature, and also the variations of temperature across mm-hmm. the sky, because this correlates to the structures we see today, and sort of that's where the interesting physics is. The more recent generation of experiments, so this is starting in, say, this century, we've been not just looking at the temperature of the CMB light, but the polarization.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if your listeners are familiar with light polarization, but light is essentially oscillating electric and magnetic fields. And so the electric field actually has a direction in which it oscillates. It mm-hmm. can oscillate up and down, left and right, and so on. And the direction of the electric field is defined as a light polarization. And some light, like most of the light you see coming off the sky primarily, or off a light bulb, is unpolarized, meaning, mm-hmm. you know, as the light waves come to you, the electric field is oriented in random directions. But we have predictions that in the early universe, the CMB should actually have some preferred polarization. And of course, why do we care? Because specific physical mechanisms lay down specific polarization patterns. And so this current generation of experiments is trying to study not just the temperature, but also the polarization of the cosmic microwave background. So QUIET is studying the polarization of the CMB, and they were a ground-based experiment. There's a couple locations on the Earth where the conditions are really good for observing. You want very thin atmosphere and very stable atmosphere. Mm-hmm. The radio and microwave light does penetrate the atmosphere, but there are certain regions where, you know, especially with less water mm-hmm. and so on, or oxygen, you get less absorption and you can get better measurements. So QUIET is in the Atacama Desert in Chile, and it had, I believe, 91 and 40 detectors in the 90 gigahertz band and the 40 gigahertz band. Those are the frequency ranges where the CMB light peaks, and it also is able to travel through the Earth's atmosphere.
Just tell me a little bit more about that light polarization then. Yeah. Why would it be polarized, the early light from the Big Bang, and what would that mean?
Yeah, so there's three things that can cause polarization. Number one, in the early universe, mm-hmm. as I mentioned, you know, you have this very amorphous sort of soup of protons, electrons, so on. And you also have gravitational potential wells, just meaning that you have areas where matter is falling inward and gathering, and this actually produced the structures we see today. Mm-hmm. So in these potential wells, you'll now find galaxies and clusters of galaxies and superclusters of galaxies. And between the wells, you find voids, mm-hmm. big regions of empty space. And because of the way the matter was sort of clumping and sort of the light photons were being brought with it, because of that, you get these hot and cold regions that we already knew about from previous experiments, and they also lay down a polarization pattern. And it's simply because if you have this temperature pattern existing around an electron, when that electron scatters light to the observer, mm-hmm. it produces a preferred polarization. And so in one sense, these polarization measurements helped us confirm what we already know about the temperature data, sure. or also provide, since it's a different data set, it actually allows us to access different sort of cosmological parameters about the history of the universe and so on. So it did provide new information as well. But there's another signal that's primordial that's the one that we're going after now, and this is the one that people are extremely excited about. And this is called the gravitational wave mm-hmm. signal. So we believe that one possible sort of beginning of the universe is inflation, where in the first fraction of a second of the universe, like something like 10 to the minus 43 seconds, the universe expanded at superluminal speeds. Matter didn't travel faster mm-hmm. than light, but space expanded. Space itself expanded faster than light. This explains a lot of mysteries. For example, why did the CMB look so uniform across the sky when two parts of the universe shouldn't have been able to communicate at that time? It's called the horizon problem. So this inflation theory actually helps explain a number of mysteries or sort of puzzles in cosmology. And all of our evidence of our, you know, other scientific evidence is consistent with it, yet we don't really have a strong sort of smoking gun for inflation yet. And there are alternate theories. Mm-hmm. And by the inflation, it's a sort of a model. There's many different inflationary theories within the idea of inflation. And so back to this idea of inflation and polarization, if inflation happened in certain inflationary models, there's a polarization signal we should see in the cosmic microwave background from gravitational waves that propagated mm-hmm. from early times. And if we can see that signal, and we're just at the sort of limit, all these groups of experiments, not just EBEX and QUIET and so on, if we're able to see this signal, we'd have a smoking gun for inflation. We'd have an understanding of what was the energy of the universe at that time, the energy scale mm-hmm. at that time. And it would then help us understand these other mysteries have now been explained. So it would be a really exciting result if, in fact, we see that polarization signal.
Let's talk about EBEX then. Tell me the background to how this experiment first came about.
Well, this experiment was a collaboration amongst a number of universities in the United States, and also we have a bunch of European colleagues as well. And in the United States, the people who've actually been building the instrument are Berkeley, University of Minnesota, Columbia, and Brown. And each university takes on a particular part of the experiment, sort of, you know, takes responsibility for a particular aspect of it. And, you know, then we get together and work on integrating the experiment and testing it and so on. And then finally we put it all together mm-hmm. and fly it over Antarctica. And it's sort of the same way any experiment does. A group of faculty get together, they write a grant to NASA. NASA says, yes, we will fund you. You know, you grab a bunch of grad students. And this all started, our funding sort of started at the beginning of 2005. So mm-hmm. we've been working since the beginning of 2005 to build this instrument. And we did it, what's called an engineering flight or a test flight, which is a very short flight where you're just testing a bunch of basic systems. You know that during that flight, you'll never reach your science goals, mm-hmm. but you're just doing some basic tests. And, you know, this is as much for the scientist as it is for NASA. So NASA mm-hmm. requires it for a new type of experiment, a new experimental group coming together. Sometimes they'll waive it if it's an experimental group with a lot of heritage. And, you know, we did that launch from Fort Sumner, New Mexico in 2009. So we've already flown this up to the edge of space, to the top of the stratosphere once in 2009. And then since then, we've been finishing everything up. We didn't have a complete set of detectors, so all of our pixels, mm-hmm. so to speak, weren't yet produced. And we've been, you know, reworking things that didn't work during that flight. And then this summer we'll be in Texas at a NASA facility in Palestine, Texas, with our colleagues from those universities integrating everything up. And then we'll be going to Antarctica at the end of the year. And by the way, I left out one non-American university, which is McGill, and they've played a huge role in the detector readout. And they'll be with us in Texas as well.
I want to talk a little bit more about that, how that test flight went. But yeah. First of all, EBEX is an acronym for E and B experiment, yeah. which actually doesn't give much more away than EBEX. So what does E and B yeah. experiment mean?
So the E and B are the two signals that are decomposed out of the polarized light. So if you were looking at a map of the sky, you could, you know, have a, say, a false color map mm-hmm. of the different temperatures. And you could also lay down a bunch of polarization rods. And these are just, they're vectors, but they don't have a head. So they're these rods and this laid all over the sky, showing that direction of that electric field vector as the light is coming towards mm-hmm. us. And you can look at that pattern and think, okay, what does this tell me? But you want to relate that back to the physics that's producing the polarization in the first place. And so, you know, you go to your theorists, of which we have many on our experiment, and you say, okay, help us understand what type of patterns would have been produced by what kind of physics in the early universe. And they can come back, and it turns out that the best way to understand the physics in that polarization pattern is by decomposing it into what we call E modes and B modes. And mm-hmm. this is sort of just a technical thing. And if people, if your listeners are familiar with electromagnetism, the E modes are curl-free, just like electric fields, and the B modes are divergence-free, just like magnetic fields. So the nomenclature sort of harks back to electric and magnetic fields, but doesn't really have anything to do with it directly. So this is essentially the two signals that we can detect in the polarization of the CMB, and the E mode has been detected already, so we're still learning new information from it. However, the B mode has not, and that is the signal that's produced only by the gravitational waves. I meant to add this before, that there's that third polarized signal, which is caused when the CMB, which is sort of traveling through the universe to us, interacts with all the matter in between that place far away where the mm-hmm. light comes from and the Earth. And when it interacts with that matter, the E modes and B modes can sort of be mixed up. And so you can get a sort of a third signal from what we call lensing mm-hmm. of the light by matter along the line of sight.
Let's talk about that test run then. You go down to yeah. New Mexico mm-hmm. To test this balloon first of all. So it must be quite trepidatious to actually be testing such a critical piece of equipment like that. How did it actually go on the day?
We had mixed results. Some things did work, and it was, you know, the first time that we had this particular type of microwave detector or sort of pixel used not on the Earth. Mm-hmm. And you think, well, you know, why not just test everything on the ground and then put it up in space and it works, right? But it doesn't, because these detectors care about how much atmosphere they're looking mm-hmm. through. So you have to make a lot of predictions about the conditions up at the float altitudes around 110,000 feet and about how your particular detector device is going to respond to those conditions. So that was exciting. And it was also the first time that we had an electronics package which had been engineered to be extremely low power. So at McGill, they were able to reduce the power consumption by a factor of 10 whole order of magnitude. And that allowed us to actually put this on a balloon and be able to power it. Mm-hmm. So it's not too much of a power hog, because eventually we need to power with solar panels, and you can't have an obscenely large, you know, area of solar panels. And also getting rid of heat is a big challenge mm-hmm. in a balloon-borne experiment, because the only way you can get rid of heat is through radiation. Up at those altitudes, there's virtually no atmosphere. It's about a thousandth of the pressure down on the Earth, so there's no convection. And sure, you can conduct within your experiment, but in the end, you got to get rid of it, or else your whole experiment's just going to keep heating up, and you get rid of the heat through radiation. And so that was a real big feat that readout system worked successfully. We had one mechanical failure during the launch. There's a 1,000-foot tether between the top of the experiment and the balloon, and it's under an amazing amount of tension because the balloon is just pulling up on it. So it's pulling up really, really hard. So there's thousands of pounds of tension. And when the balloon was released, it was just not quite over the experiment, but leaning a bit forward. And so the experiment sort of jerked forward off. And that caused something called our elevation actuator to break. The elevation actuator is this basically a screw that pushes our telescope up and down. So it controls where we're looking mm-hmm. in the sky. And that was a major bummer, because we weren't able to complete sort of the raster scans mm-hmm. that we had planned. But you live and learn, and that's why you do a test flight, because, of course, there is a big investment in sort of everybody's time, including NASA and the experimental team, and the helium alone costs. At that time, I was told about $250,000, but now helium is even in shorter supply, and I imagine costs significantly more. But compared to going to Antarctica, that's not a big mm-hmm. investment. So, you know, you try to make your mistakes and learn your lessons earlier on, and then when you go for the real show, you'll hopefully be prepared.
I want to talk a little bit about the practicalities of the balloon then, because you said space, but whereabouts, how high is it actually yeah. going? Where will it be positioned?
We say the edge of space. It's actually just at the top of the stratosphere, and there's four layers, and we're really only at the top of the second one. There's the troposphere, and then the stratosphere, and then you have the mesosphere and ionosphere. Mm-hmm. So we're not in space. But, you know, as I said, we're really above the majority of the atmosphere. The atmospheric pressure doesn't decrease linearly as you go up. The pressure is much higher closer to the Earth, and then it really thins out pretty quick. And so that gets us just high enough to do the measurements we want to do without, you know, because some people might say, why not just make a satellite? Why bother with a balloon? But they're really two completely different and parallel paths. Mm-hmm. And the balloon path can produce new science, and it has made a lot of significant discoveries in CMB, and in sort of you can study cosmic rays, you can study the Earth and the ice, you know, in Antarctica. You can learn a lot from a balloon, but you also prove technology on a balloon for a satellite. Mm-hmm. So as I mentioned, you know, our detectors, we can't really test them on the ground. We can't test them properly. And so you would never take a detector that you've just tested in the lab on the ground and done some calculations and put them in a satellite. Mm-hmm. You always would want to put it on a balloon platform, perhaps even more than once. So it really is plays an important role in sort of developing technology and proving technology to go in a satellite. People might imagine that a satellite has the absolute cutting-edge technology, but it's not true, because you would never want to put something in there that hasn't really been tested and tried and true on both ground-based and balloon-borne experiments, and really has a strong heritage.
What actually happens to the balloon as it goes up? You said it's a helium balloon,
yeah.
And helium, I guess, will expand, does it?
As yeah.
it gets sort of higher?
Yeah, so when the balloon's on the ground, you know, before launch, the balloon has this shape. It's sort of round at the top, but it's very squeezed down. And that's just because the air pressure, the atmospheric pressure on the Earth's surface, is pressing hard against the balloon. But as it goes up, it pumpkins out, it balloons out and into much more sort of rounder, ellipsoid form. And the helium can keep the payload up there for 30, 40 days, many, many days. We plan to only be above Antarctica for about something like 11 or 14 days. And we're really limited by how long our liquid helium and our liquid nitrogen cryogens last. That's going to be the limiting factor for how long we can observe. But there are other experiments that stay up there much, much longer.
Where do you expect? I mean, does it move? Will it be, you know, where will it end up?
When yeah.
we go forward to Antarctica, where will you, like, you'll launch the balloon, but the balloon is not going to come down at the
no, launch point. In the same place. Usually it doesn't. There was one experiment called Boomerang, and it did, in fact, land very close wow. to McMurdo Base, where it's launched from. But on another experimental run, it landed completely diametrically opposed on the other side of the continent. But one reason Antarctica is a nice place to launch balloons is you launch the balloon from McMurdo, which isn't at the South Pole. Mm-hmm. It's on the coast of Antarctica. And at the time of year that we're there, which is the Antarctic summer, so starting, you know, launching probably as early as maybe December 1, sometime in December, the balloon gets carried around the South Pole with circumpolar winds. And so there are periods where it can be over water, but it, you know, it doesn't go flying off to the equator. It mm-hmm. stays sort of within this region. And so that doesn't mean that it's going to land right where you want it to land. And there have been, you know, in the case of Boomerang, they one year had to leave their payload through the winter because they weren't able to recover everything. I think they were able to get the data, and that, mm-hmm. you know, that's really all you care about the most. I mean, there's certain instruments that you'd love to recover because you could reuse them and they're expensive. But once you get the data, you can spend that next year, half a year, analyzing the data and so on, getting started on that. You know, otherwise, you can't control exactly where it goes down. They do have explosive bolts and they send a command so they can control when it comes down. Mm-hmm. But for whatever reason, they might decide to bring it down when it's not near McMurdo Station, but it's not going to fly off elsewhere.
And when it comes down, it will drop with some...
with some heft, yeah. It's they do have a parachute.
Yeah.
And even then, it comes down at something like, you know, 35 miles per hour or so. And you can get anything from a disastrous landing to, you know, it can come down right on its feet, nice and easy. And a lot of that depends on how much lateral wind there is. Mm-hmm. When we landed from our New Mexico launch, we landed at the Arizona-California border. They don't let you go into California because of the LAX airspace. They, of course, don't let you go into Mexico. Mm-hmm. And so there's sort of all these bounds that are going to limit the length of the flight in North America. When we came down, there was clearly a wind coming from the side because the whole experiment toppled over, but it fell on its back. And so all of our sort of specialized electronics that all the graduate students and postdocs had been building by hand for years, and the optics, the mirrors, which would really become damaged in a fall and are expensive and take time to reproduce, they all were fine. Mm-hmm. So we actually, you know, we did rebuild some of our frame, but that was like buying I-beams from McMaster. You know, it was very simple and straightforward. So that was, even though there was a significant amount of damage, the right thing got damaged, not the wrong thing.
Have you been to Antarctica before?
I have not, no.
So what's that going to be like?
Well, it's going to be a lot of hard work. When we go into the field, we work typically, you know, through the weekend. We work basically as many hours as you can effectively, which amounts to usually about 13 to 15, 16-hour days. Because, you know, really, once you're down there, you know, you're not with your spouse or your friends or whatever, and you just want to get everything done as quickly as possible. It's also expensive to be in the field, whether you're in Texas or in Antarctica. It's expensive personally because you're... Mm-hmm. You have no personal contact. I'm told we get one shower every 3 days.
Wow.
Yeah. And I'm told that the NSF, National Science Foundation, based down in McMurdo, is very oversubscribed. And so, you know, you're bunking with other people. And nonetheless, everyone comes back and says it's extremely exciting. You know, it might not be the most comfortable time you've mm-hmm. had, but it's certainly not rustic either. And it's sort of a once-in-a-lifetime experience. Yeah.
How long are you there for?
Our team will probably be there, I would imagine, for about 2 months. Mm-hmm. You know, it all depends on how long it takes you to get ready. And then the way it works with NASA, they'll have multiple balloon payloads per campaign, whether it's in New Mexico or Sweden or Antarctica. And whoever's ready first is first in the queue. And so, you know, it depends on when you get ready and when you tell NASA, okay, we're hands off, everything is working, we're not going to touch anything. And when did everybody else say that? And, you know, if you're later in the queue, we're a relatively big experiment, so I imagine we won't be the first to be ready to go. Then you're going to be waiting a little bit longer, and it really depends on the weather. I mean, we waited for 2 weeks in New Mexico for the right conditions mm-hmm. to launch.
To finish up then, we haven't talked about what the science goals of this experiment
yeah.
actually are. So
yeah.
What do we expect to find?
Well, the first goal is to detect this B-mode signal. And that's really the driving force behind the experimental design. We want to detect the signal, the B-mode from gravitational waves, if it exists. We, you know, from inflation, mm-hmm. Which we aren't sure it's there, but we would like to either detect it, or even if we don't detect it, we reduce the upper limit. And that sounds probably kind of unexciting, but it actually can rule out a lot of existing inflationary theories. So mm-hmm. it can be significant if you get a good reduction in the upper limit. And then the second thing we want to do is measure the B-mode signal coming from the foreground matter that lenses the CMB. And that will tell us about sort of the integrated matter along the line of sight. And so that can probe the rate at which structure grows, the shape of space. Is space curved? Is it flat? Neutrino species, number of neutrino species. So there's a number of sort of secondary science goals in the lensing signal. But the gravitational wave signal from inflation is definitely the most exciting and sort of the driving force behind the design of the experiment.
And when will you expect to be publishing that data, I guess, once you've done the experiment and gathered the data? When?
Yeah, so we'll fly at the end of this year, and then analysis will take anywhere from, say, 2 to 3 years. So, I mean, we're going to have terabytes of data. It's a very large data set.
That's a good point for us to end. So I've been talking to Britt Reichborn Chenerud. Britt, thank you very much for talking to me today.
Thanks so much.
I'm Lucianne Walkwich, and that was a Little Atoms Road Trip podcast. The show was produced and presented by Neil Denny and was made possible by a traveling fellowship from the Winston Churchill Memorial Trust. Follow the trip on Twitter at Little Atoms, and thanks for listening.